Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
We also explain words and language rules, all while bringing you stories and information from around the world. Today on the program, you will hear stories from Brian Lynn, Mario Ritter, Bruce Alpert, Phil Dierking, and Jill Robbins. Brian Lynn has our first story.
The next President of the United States, Donald Trump, has begun appointing members of his White House team. The president-elect chose his top two advisors on Sunday. He is expected to name more appointments this week. His first two choices demonstrate two very different styles of politics. Trump chose the national chairman of the Republican Party, Reince Priebus, as his chief of staff. This position generally controls most operations at the White House. The chief of staff also helps set the president's daily activities and decides who gets to meet with him. The 44-year-old Priebus has headed the Republican National Committee since 2011. His political skills helped elect Trump and resulted in Republicans keeping control of both houses of Congress after the elections last week. Some observers say the choice of Priebus sends a message to party officials and congressional leaders that Trump is willing to keep ties with the Republican political establishment. The other top White House job went to Stephen Bannon, whom Trump named as his chief strategist and senior advisor. Bannon served as the chief executive officer of Trump's election campaign. In a statement, Trump called Priebus and Bannon qualified leaders who worked well together on our campaign and led us to a historic victory. He added, "Now I will have them both with me in the White House as we work to make America great again." Democratic Party activists, civil rights groups, and even some Republicans quickly criticized the choice of Bannon. Before joining the Trump campaign, Bannon led the Breitbart News website. Under his leadership, the website published stories supporting nationalist, anti-establishment positions. It also had many stories in support of Trump and others critical of Hillary Clinton, the Democrats' presidential candidate. Bannon once described the news site as a platform for what has been called the alternative right, or alt-right. The alt-right means a right-wing movement that publicizes, largely on the internet, nationalist, racist, and sexist ideas. Breitbart News has been criticized for using news headlines with racist and sexist overtones. One story about a conservative commentator was called "Republican Spoiler, Renegade Jew." Another headline read, "Birth Control Makes Women Unattractive and Crazy." while yet another asked, "Would you rather your child had feminism or cancer?" The Anti-Defamation League is one group condemning Bannon's appointment. The ADL's director, Jonathan Greenblatt, called it a sad day when a man with Bannon's history is chosen to be a senior member of the People's House. Greenblatt called on the president-elect to appoint and nominate Americans committed to the well-being of all of our country's people. The leading Democrat in the House of Representatives, Nancy Pelosi, said Bannon's appointment sent an alarming signal that President-elect Trump remains committed to the hateful and divisive vision that defined his campaign. John Weaver, an advisor for Republican Ohio Governor John Kasich, tweeted that the racist, fascist extreme right is represented footsteps from the Oval Office. "Be very vigilant, America," he wrote. On Tuesday, Trump met with Vice President-elect Mike Pence in New York to discuss other appointments. Trump campaign manager Kellyanne Conway said his team is also making plans to choose a replacement for Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Scalia died in February 2016. Since his death, the High Court has had 8 members instead of the usual 9. I'm Brian Lynn.
A former United States official says President-elect Donald Trump would take action against North Korea to destroy a standing missile armed with a nuclear weapon. Christopher Hill formerly served as the U.S. Ambassador to Iraq and Assistant Secretary of State for East Asian and Pacific Affairs. Hill also led the U.S. team during the 6-party talks on North Korea's nuclear activity under President George W. Bush. The 6-party talks involved North and South Korea, China, Japan, Russia, and the United States. However, all 6 nations have not met on the nuclear issue since 2009. Hill was in Seoul to speak at a South Korean government conference on the chances for peace and unification on the Korean Peninsula. He sought to signal a change in U.S. policy.
So I think North Korea needs to understand that there is going to be a new sheriff in Washington.
With his statement, Hill noted the president-elect's willingness to take action against a possible North Korean threat. He also tried to reassure America's allies that the U.S. government will honor its security agreements in Asia. Not all those who attended the conference were in agreement. Gareth Evans formerly served as Australia's foreign minister. Evans said he is worried the American president-elect would act impulsively against an aggressive opponent. He also is concerned that such an action could start a wider conflict.
But where's that going to take us? A preemptive military strike? I mean, that's premised on the assumption that if the North Koreans have a nuclear weapon and have a missile delivery capability, the United States and everyone else is at real risk. But what on earth is ever going to encourage the North Koreans to use such a missile in that situation?
Evans said that, as a candidate, Trump had caused allies to question the U.S. commitment to defending them and securing peace in Asia. North Korea has expanded its nuclear development program this year. The North's government has tested 2 nuclear devices and many long- and medium-range missiles. Experts say within 5 years, North Korea will be able to launch an intercontinental missile armed with a small nuclear warhead. Hill also noted that moderate foreign policy specialists from the Republican Party are among those on Trump's national security transition team. He said they are placing importance on stability and continuity in North Korean policy. During the election campaign, candidate Trump had criticized some U.S. allies for not providing enough support for defense efforts in Asia. The South Korean Defense Ministry has said the division of defense costs is fair. A ministry spokesman also said that South Korea is unwilling to pay more for the deployment of the THAAD missile defense system. As a presidential candidate, Trump voiced support for allies gaining possession of nuclear weapons. Later, he denied the statement. After the election, the president-elect promised to continue American security commitments. He did so during phone calls with South Korean President Park Geun-hye and Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe. Abe is planning to meet with Trump later this month before a meeting of the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Group in Lima, Peru. Last week, the office of South Korea's president said Trump told Park, "We are with you all the way, and we will not waver." Ambassador Hill says actions after the election show the importance of the U.S. alliances with Japan and South Korea in stopping North Korean threats and China's military power.
But I have no doubt that the U.S. administration, the Trump administration, will be able to continue what is really one of our best relationships in the world.
Hill also said he opposed offering unconditional talks or engagement with the North. He said that the government of Kim Jong-un must first agree to halt its nuclear weapons program. Hill admitted that getting China's assistance for new sanctions on North Korea will be difficult if trade relations with the United States worsen. Trump has criticized China's trade policies and threatened import taxes on Chinese goods. I'm Mario Ritter.
When Donald Trump was a candidate for president, he criticized scientists who blame pollution for rising temperatures on Earth's surface. Trump rejected scientific documentation of climate change, calling it a hoax or unreal. And he promised to pull out of the Paris Agreement on climate change. That agreement was the product of negotiations involving about 200 countries. Trump won the presidential election in the United States. He will replace Barack Obama as president on January 20, 2017. Government officials and scientists are in Morocco this month for climate talks. They worry that if Trump pulls out of the Paris Agreement, as he promised, it will have a major effect on their work. This is critical to protect our planet, safeguard the most vulnerable, and drive shared prosperity, said United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon. He spoke at the opening of the conference in Marrakesh. Ban said he hopes Donald Trump will listen to scientists and understand the seriousness of climate change. Trump has said he plans to pull back from Obama's climate change rules during his first 100 days in office. He said he wants to put American coal miners back to work and make the United States more energy independent. Mike Duncan heads the American Coalition for Clean Coal Electricity. The group opposes Obama administration climate change regulations. Duncan told VOA that Trump can move the country away from costly rules that limited our access to affordable and reliable power. Al Gore served as U.S. Vice President during the administration of former President Bill Clinton. Gore has been warning for years that temperatures will continue rising if greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide are not reduced. And that means more deadly storms and natural disasters and land falling into the sea, he said. Gore released a statement after Trump won the presidential election. President-elect Trump said he wanted to be a president for all Americans, Gore said. In that spirit, I hope that he will work with the overwhelming majority of us who believe that the climate crisis is the greatest threat we face as a nation. Trump's election was likely to be a subject of discussion at the climate conference taking place in Marrakesh, Morocco. The meeting was called to discuss the next steps to move the Paris Agreement forward. I'm Bruce Alpert.
Adults in the Netherlands are the best non-native English speakers. A new report released Tuesday says. The report also says that Iraq has fallen to last place. The private education company Education First, or EF, released the 2016 English Proficiency Index report. The English Proficiency Index is based on the online test scores of 950,000 adults from 72 countries. The results do not show the English ability of a country's entire population. They are based on people who took an online test, the EF Standard English Test, or EFSET, during 2015. You can take the test online for free. The study is the sixth produced by EF. It is a yearly report that examines the English knowledge level of adults from 72 countries. It has found most areas in the world are continuing to improve their English language ability. The report also says that English language remains an important part for a country's economic power. According to EF Director of Research Min Chun, one quality the highest-ranking countries share is a strong education system. However, he says that may not be enough.
However, another very important factor is whether your country has an English-speaking environment. If you go to Singapore today, you'll see that you hear English on the street, right? You hear Singaporean youngsters mixing Chinese, Malay, and English. Singaporeans are watching TV, watching films, listening to music in English.
Chun also said the report has found a gender difference in English ability.
If you look at the genders, women are better than men. And we've seen that in nearly every country, every age group, every industry, even when we look at business English. So women are just consistently outperforming men.
Similar to the previous 6 years, Europe leads the rankings with its overall strength in English. Netherlands, Denmark, Sweden, Norway, and Finland were the top 5 countries in Europe and in the world. These countries have been in the top 5 almost every year the report has been released. The only difference is that the Netherlands has moved from 2nd place to 1st this year. The report says there are several reasons these countries perform well. They have strong education systems, and primary and secondary schools in those countries require English language studies. There are also many chances for people to use English in their day-to-day lives. The report says one very helpful quality is that English is used often in the media of these Northern European countries. One important change took place in France. It moved from the low proficiency category last year to moderate proficiency for 2016. France placed 24th out of 28 European countries included in the report.
English is a sensitive issue in France because the country is very proud of French and the position of French, the French language in the world. Universities do not teach in English, whereas other universities in Europe do have programs even entirely in English. So we've seen France go down in the past 5 years, and this year was the first year that they came back up.
The lowest performing countries in what the report considers Europe were Azerbaijan and Turkey. Those countries made small improvements from last year, but their scores were lower than the rest of Europe. The report says these countries tend to have weaker teaching methods that depend on rote memorization rather than communication.
In Asia, Singapore was the highest-ranked country, moving to 6th place in the index. Singapore was considered to have a very high proficiency level for the first time. Chun says this improvement is because Singapore has a very strong education system.
Well, Singapore's education system is often seen as one of the best in the world. If you look at other English tests like IELTS and TOEFL, Singapore is consistently at the top. And not just in Asia, right, but throughout the world. And it just has a very, very strong education system that focuses on quality of instruction and that has extremely high standards for their students.
Along with Singapore, Malaysia and the Philippines were the next highest-ranked countries. The report says countries with a historical link to the British Empire usually have stronger English levels than other countries in the area. However, the report says Thailand and Cambodia still have low levels of English proficiency, although they have a growing tourism industry. China also increased its rank by moving from 47th to 39th place. However, it is behind many other countries in Asia. Chun says this might be the result of its large population.
Adult English proficiency in Latin America remains less strong, the study says. Most countries had a lower rank this year than last year. Argentina is the only country to rank as high proficiency. The Dominican Republic follows closely behind. One reason for Argentina's high ranking, according to the report, is that English teachers there are highly qualified. They have to complete a 5-year training program to teach English in public schools. Latin America's largest countries, Brazil and Mexico, have lower rankings this year. This is the case, although there are efforts to send students to English-speaking countries for university studies. Chun says one reason these countries do not have higher rankings is the large size of their populations. In large countries, it takes more time for enough citizens to learn English to raise the average English level.
The Middle East and North African area had the greatest changes in scores from last year. Morocco and Qatar made the most improvements of all countries in the area. But Iraq and Oman's scores dropped the most. Only Morocco and the United Arab Emirates are in the low proficiency level. All other countries fell into the very low proficiency level. Chun says some issues causing the low performance in the Middle East and North Africa, or MENA, area are outside of the classroom.
They are countries that have experienced quite a lot of turmoil. When you have such turmoil in your country for such a long time, then it's difficult for the education system to really make a difference.
The report says that factors affecting these countries are poor education systems and not enough jobs for students after they finish school. This can cause students to not try as hard to succeed in their studies. The survey did not include sub-Saharan African countries.
Chun suggests three things for countries trying to improve their English level. First is to make quality English teaching available to all citizens. Next, a country should invest in teacher training and then invest in its English-speaking environment.
I think the number one priority would be to make sure that everybody has access to quality English instruction. And to do that, I think then it is leveraging teacher training, right? And making sure that you have a teacher supply that is able to deliver the quality instruction that you need in your entire school system. Then it is about creating that English environment in your country. It is having bilingual signs, bilingual menus, having programs in English that are not dubbed, and creating excuses for your students to speak in English, right?
The report shows that it is not easy to improve English-speaking ability countrywide, and it also is costly. But it is clear that the economic and social benefits make it worth the investment. I'm Phil Dierking.
And I'm Jill Robbins.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.